I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. It's been a confusing week regarding news about COVID-19 and the threat of the highly transmissible Delta variant that has mostly sickened the unvaccinated. The CDC announced that even if you are vaccinated, you should mask up to protect yourself and avoid breakthrough infections. Here's Dr. Rochelle Walensky, director of the CDC, speaking earlier this week.
While we desperately want to be done with this pandemic, COVID-19 is clearly not done with us, and so our battle must last a little longer. Many of us have lost loved ones or have been ill ourselves. All of us have given up things in our lives that we enjoy. This is hard, this is heavy, but we are in this together.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the U.S. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, added this.
Let's look at the real-world effectiveness against the Delta variant. The vaccines are doing exactly what we're asking them to do when it comes to keeping you out of the hospital, out of serious disease, and certainly preventing your death.
So while 70% of adults have had at least one COVID shot, there are pockets of the country where vaccination rates are well below 50%. Hesitancy and politics seem to have become the biggest barriers to getting to herd immunity. While more employers are mandating vaccines and masks, some Republican government officials are doing the opposite. For instance, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis issued an executive order to withhold funds to school boards who institute mask mandates for their students, many of whom are not vaccinated. Well, joining us to talk about all of this is Dr. John Wary. He's a professor and chair of pharmacology and director of the Institute of Immunology at the Perelman School of Medicine. That's at the University of Pennsylvania. John Wary, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, thanks, Marty. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And joining us by Skype is Dr. Celine Gounder. She is Clinical Assistant Professor of Medicine and Infectious Diseases at New York University School of Medicine and Bellevue Hospital. She's also the CEO and founder of Just Human Productions. And Dr. Gounder, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's great to be here.
And to you, let me start with you, Dr. Wary. And I was trying to decide what is the appropriate message for the show today? What is, frankly, the appropriate tone that we should have in talking about the Delta variant? And I was deciding between concern or alarm or panic or hair on fire. From your perspective, how should we be talking about this?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. I think we should be talking about it with concern. But also recognizing what we've accomplished so far. And I think we can have sort of a dual message here that, as Dr. Fauci said, the vaccines are doing exactly what we asked them to do. But we have a lot of work to do. And the longer it takes to get control of things, the more variants we're going to have to be concerned about.
To you, Dr. Gounder, and I'm thinking back a month ago, you know, we went from thinking we were making pretty good progress. If you were vaccinated, you could essentially take your mask off. You could almost see that light at the end of the tunnel. And now it's not like we're back at square one, but we're having to reverse some of the things that we could do, especially if we were vaccinated. Is this all because of Delta?
Yeah, that's right, Marty. The Delta variant is different. It is at least twice as infectious or contagious as the original strains of the virus. And that means that one infected person today can go on to infect twice as many people as they would have if they were infected early in the pandemic. And that's because people who have the Delta variant have about 1,000 times as high the level of virus in their nose and throat as they would have had with earlier strains of the virus. That means they're a lot more contagious. And we're also now starting to wonder if possibly the Delta variant is causing more severe disease because of those much higher levels of virus. We are now seeing kids and young people get very sick. And so there is something qualitatively quite different about the Delta variant.
Why is it so much more virulent, if that's the correct word?
Well, imagine if your body was under attack by one virus particle versus 1,000. Obviously, 1,000 virus particles are going to cause a lot more damage to your body than a single one. And that is the hypothesis, one of the hypotheses, that just the amount of virus, the amount of replication that's happening is potentially causing more severe disease. We are seeing more kids and young people ending up in the hospital, ending up in the ICU. It could simply be that the Delta variant is more infectious and younger people are getting swept up in all of that transmission. But it's also possible that it is, in fact, causing more severe disease than earlier strains.
Well, let me go back to you, Dr. Wary, and just talk about people who are vaccinated and how they are protected from this Delta variant. Help us understand, I guess, the risks associated with that.
Yeah, I mean, the vaccines are working to prevent severe disease, mortality, hospitalization, and the efficacy there is still very, very high. The vaccines were never designed and never tested to prevent any infection whatsoever. They were tested and designed to prevent disease. And they're still doing that. The estimates vary a little bit depending on the study, but it still looks like we have 88 to 90% efficacy preventing disease. So vaccination is definitely working. The newer data that came out this week does suggest that vaccinated people still can get infected. And even if they have either mild or no symptoms, that's a concern because they may then still be transmitting virus. And we could get into this in more detail. The fact of the matter is we don't really understand this fully yet, but we know vaccinated people can turn up what we call PCR positive for having some viral RNA in their nose and then can likely transmit that to other people. And this is the reason for masking. It would be great if we could get enough people vaccinated so that we don't transmit virus anymore, but we're not there yet. So masks are our other big, powerful tool in the toolbox to limit the spread.
I have a really dumb question, and I'll put this back to you, Dr. Wary. When people like yourself, I hear Dr. Fauci talk about disease. When you talk about disease, it means what, getting sick?
Yeah, it's sort of a gray area. So disease is getting symptoms. It's needing medical attention. It's being admitted to the hospital or ending up in the ICU. So it can be all of those things. And I think what many of the studies really tested for is how well the vaccine protects against symptomatic and severe disease. That is, being symptomatic, having a fever, and being severely ill, needing medical attention. The vaccines are still outstanding at protecting you from severe disease, hospitalization, and death. The estimates are that if you are vaccinated, your risk of death from COVID-19 is about 1 in 1 million, wow. 1 in 100,000 to 1 in 1 million. If you're not vaccinated and you catch COVID-19, your risk of dying is 1 in 30 about. So, you know, the vaccines are really doing what they're supposed to. But the vaccines, weren't designed to prevent any kind of infection, even if it's asymptomatic.
Well, let me go back to you, Dr. Gounder. I was reading a little bit about what happened in Provincetown over the 4th of July weekend. This is in a state that's highly vaccinated and apparently a part of the state where most people are vaccinated. And there were these breakthrough infections that got a lot of press coverage, a lot of attention. What should we know about that? And breakthrough infections among people who are vaccinated.
I think the story of Provincetown is actually a story of success, and I think it was really misconstrued in the media. I think the headline should have been, hey, if everybody gets vaccinated, COVID won't be a big deal. We can turn COVID into something much more mild like the flu through vaccination. As you said, most people in Provincetown were vaccinated. Some people had some mild cough, cold, flu-like symptoms. A handful of people ended up in the hospital and nobody died. And what I think one of the key barometers of what is disease, as you were just asking, did somebody's oxygen levels drop? And, you know, by that measure alone, the vaccines are highly protective in preventing against what we would call severe disease from COVID. It's, you know, it's when your oxygen levels drop that we really worry. It's not when you have a mild cough or maybe feel a little bit feverish. It's when you're really in danger of getting much sicker when your oxygen levels drop. So Provincetown is a success. That is what the world could look like post-pandemic if we get enough people vaccinated.
And yet, as I think you were referencing there, Dr. Gounder, the headlines and a lot of the stories, at least the first couple of paragraphs, were about this breakthrough infections and the fact that hundreds of people felt sick.
Yeah, but we don't vaccinate for the common cold.
Right.
we vaccinate for things that kill you. And that's the measure for success here is, are the vaccinations saving people's lives? And by that measure, yes, 100%.
And the idea of being vaccinated, I'm back to you, Dr. Gander, being vaccinated and wearing a mask, help us understand, I guess, the protection that offers both the mask wearer, but also the general public.
Well, the mask prevents transmission of infection in two different ways. So if you are, let's say, whether you're vaccinated or not, you are carrying infection. Maybe you have symptoms, maybe you don't. But if you have infection and you're wearing a mask, you are trapping those virus particles inside that mask so that you can't spread onward to others. And this is why the CDC is also recommending that even if you've been vaccinated, because some people very rarely can have breakthrough infections, could transmit, that they continue wearing a mask. For people who are at risk of getting infection, by wearing a mask, you're reducing the number of virus particles you're inhaling. And I do think one thing we need to emphasize here is also the quality of the mask. Some masks are better than others. At the beginning of the pandemic, we were in a scarcity situation where there was a shortage of medical grade masks. So the lay public, the general public was advised to wear cloth masks, which provides some level of protection, but they're not as good as surgical masks and other masks we use in the hospital. At this stage in the pandemic, many of us are recommending, because we don't have that same scarcity issue anymore, that people wear at a minimum what we call a KN95 mask, and then leave the N95s for medical workers in the hospital.
Fair enough. Let me go back to you, Dr. Wary. Here's a question from Kurt. How far can the Delta variant travel in an airborne state? Do we know?
That's a great question. As far as I'm aware, there's no evidence that it behaves differently than any of the other strains from these airborne transmissions. And so the virus particle itself is very similar to the original strains and some of the other variants that are out there in terms of size and shape and you know, distance they can travel. And this is why we have this 6-foot rule. And so the general idea is that particulates that emerge from your nose or mouth, if you cough heavy breathing or talking loudly, 6 feet is a good distance where the vast majority of those particles will actually fall to the ground and not be inhaled by the next person. So I think that's still a good rule of thumb. Close contact with people, especially talking loudly, if people are coughing, sneezing, things like that, are high risk events. And this is why we've seen evidence of high transmission in bars and in crowded areas and things where people are speaking loudly and interacting in close quarters. So I think the 6-foot social distancing rule of thumb is still a very good guideline, even for the Delta variant.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. I want to pick up on several things. That's Dr. John Wary. He's chair of pharmacology, director of the Institute for Immunology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Also with us is Dr. Celine Gounder. She's a clinical assistant professor of medicine and infectious diseases at New York University School of Medicine and Bellevue Hospital. We're getting an update on this Delta variant. There have been some changes in masking requirements and recommendations coming from CDC and others. There are also more calls for mandating vaccinations. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone, talking with our guests about the latest science and guidance for COVID, the Delta variant, vaccines, masking mandates, what you need to know to stay safe. And you can join us by sending us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Dr. Gounder, just picking up on what Dr. Wary was talking about before the break about masks, should people just get in the habit of wearing masks? And if you're out in public with people that you don't know, just slip a mask on.
Yeah, many of us questioned the CDC relaxing the guidance back in May for people who were fully vaccinated. The fact is, people behave as social animals. They do what other people around them are doing. And so if everybody around you is not wearing a mask, doesn't feel like they have to wear a mask, they will not wear a mask regardless of whether they are vaccinated or not. And that's precisely how we've seen this play out across the country. We had no system for enforcing who is wearing a mask or not. And so in the absence of that, and in the absence of people truly behaving as individuals, but rather as social beings, it really does make sense for everybody to be wearing a mask indoors, whether or not they are vaccinated, until the vast majority of people are eventually vaccinated.
And the vast majority, do we need to get to what, 90%? Or what's the goal here?
That's a very good question. And this is somewhat of a moving target, because as the virus continues to mutate, as it becomes more infectious, that holy grail of herd immunity, that number you need to get to, keeps going up and up and up. Uh-huh. And I don't think any of us think we're going to get to herd immunity. I don't think it's in our reach anymore, frankly. I think the virus has just become too infectious, and there will always be some proportion of people who refuse no matter what. But I think if we could get to, 75-80% of the population vaccinated, we would be in a very different place with respect to things like masking.
Dr. Ware, do we just have to learn to live with COVID as best we can?
Yeah, I think that's always been the end game here. I mean, just to put it in perspective, we've only ever eliminated one infectious agent from humans, and that's smallpox. We've come very close with polio, and we may eventually get there. But that's not really a realistic goal here. Even measles, one of the more concerning viruses that's very infectious. We continue to see pockets pop up here and there, because of low vaccine coverage or other things. So I suspect that that's where we'll end up with SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19 disease, where we'll have, smoldering pockets here and there that hopefully we can contain, whereas the rest of the country and rest of the world actually operates in a reasonably protected setting.
Hmm. So some will get sick, some will die. I mean, more like the seasonal flu, Dr. Ware?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's eventually where we're heading. We still don't fully understand the seasonality of this virus as well as we do for flu, although it seems to have patterns to it like that, and seasonal coronaviruses tell us that too. But I do suspect that we're going to end up living with this virus rather than seeing it completely eradicated.
This is more a political question, but it is also a public health question. I'm putting this to you, Dr. Ware. Should masks be mandated? Should vaccinations be mandated?
Well, I mean, I think this depends on the setting. And I completely agree with Dr. Gounder that, it probably was, it didn't help to step this back in May when the CDC relaxed the masking guidelines. I think it's still very valuable to mask. It limits spread. I think what I would be hopeful for is that we see individual businesses and individual communities, local governments really enforcing or recommending masks, or maybe even mandating masks where they can, when virus transmission levels are high. I'm hopeful that we'll see some businesses and even government agencies mandating vaccination and masking in some settings. We just heard on your sort of news introduction that the big three automakers are instituting a mask mandate and encouraging vaccination. Yeah. We should be doing that at our public schools, and I'm not sure we are across the country.
Well, let me pick up on that. Let me go back to you, Dr. Gounder, and I should say to our listeners, we have a mask mandate in this building where I work. You cannot be in this building unless you are vaccinated. Should we go in that direction, Dr. Gounder?
Yeah, I think many local jurisdictions are going in that direction. Some places with respect to a mandate, some places like New York City, a very strong guidance and advice. But I do think, in light of what we're seeing with the Delta variant, with this high transmissibility, with the fact that many people are still not vaccinated, that it really is the right thing to do to be masking indoors, at least for the next couple months. Hopefully in that time, we'll be able to get a lot more people vaccinated and won't have to continue masking in that way.
I'm looking at a story in this morning. Upper Marion Area School District, that's just outside of Philadelphia, is requiring teachers and staff to get vaccinated or wear a mask and submit to routine COVID-19 testing this fall. I'm quoting from the Philadelphia Inquirer. Dr. Gounder, if we're talking about schools and students and teachers, what should we do to protect them?
I think schools are a place we absolutely 100% should be masking indoors. And the CDC has said for K through 12 schools, that is their guidance. And remember, the CDC cannot enforce guidance. It provides technical advice and recommendations, but that is their guidance. And that is in no small part, one, because the Delta variant is more infectious, but also because children under 12 are not yet eligible to get vaccinated. We believe that sometime this fall, children 5 to 11 will become eligible, but they are not yet. And so given that not everybody can be vaccinated, we really do need to be layering every single tool in the toolbox. So that includes masking, that includes optimizing ventilation, that includes testing. We need to be doing everything that we have. And even then, we may continue to use some of these other tools down the line. Vaccinations are great, but they may not be the silver bullet.
Interesting. And Dr. Wary, I noticed that the American Academy of Pediatrics said opening schools in the fall is a priority. Anything we should do to make sure that students and staff and teachers, that people are as safe as they can be?
Yeah, I'll just reiterate what Dr. Gounder said. I think we need to use all of the tools at our disposal to make it safe. My opinion is that we should be mandating vaccination for school staff where we can. This is no different than measles or other vaccines. And we should be using social distancing, masking, better ventilation, and testing programs to make sure to minimize the risk to our students.
I mean, we do mandate things for schools, right, Dr. Wary? I mean,
yes.
I mean, it's not unusual to ask that children be inoculated against certain contagious diseases.
That's right. That's exactly right. And, you know, I think this falls in that same category. It may help some of these discussions once the FDA officially approves these vaccines, so it's not an EUA anymore, but they're officially licensed. That may help some of these discussions, but I think you're exactly right. We do mandate other things for children to go to school.
And to Dr. Gounder, the FDA, I was reading this morning, the FDA sounds like they're going to make their decision around Labor Day. Does it seem like it's taking them overly long to make a decision about these vaccines?
I don't think so. The amount of data that they have to review for a full approval, the thousands, literally tens of thousands of pages of data that they're having to review, having to do inspections of manufacturing plants. I mean, it's a whole other level of rigor that goes into a full approval. And not to mention that they're also having to decide on what's the best regimen. Is it the regimens that were used in the phase three clinical trials, so late phase clinical trials, or have we learned more since then? Should we be recommending something slightly different? You know, it's very complicated. They have allocated additional staff to this in recent weeks because they do view this as a very high priority. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this is not a straightforward process, and I do think we need to let that play out.
And you think once they do give approval, I mean, I don't want to get ahead of the story, obviously, but it looks like they will, that will be a sign to some that they feel comfortable getting a vaccine, Dr. Gounder?
I am very skeptical about that. The Kaiser Family Foundation recently did some polling around this, and they have been throughout the pandemic, about people's attitudes. There are some people in the wait and see group who say maybe they would get vaccinated, but at the same time, it's clear that many of these same people don't really understand the difference between an emergency use authorization and a full approval. And having been in some of these kinds of focus groups myself, my impression is, frankly, that it's really just a polite way of saying, I've already decided I don't want it.
Oh, interesting.
And so I'm not convinced. I think where the full approval will have an impact is it will give employers a little bit more legal cover, so to speak, to mandate vaccinations. And I think that's really where the power of the full approval is going to be.
And that is Dr. Celine Gounder. She's a New York University infectious disease specialist who joins us along with Dr. John Wary from the University of Pennsylvania. He's an immunologist. And we're getting up to speed on a week of very busy news related to COVID, to masking, to this Delta variant. We've got a lot of people with a lot of questions. Let me just make sure everyone can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. And you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Dr. Wary, Paul asks, I had COVID in February. How well am I protected from the Delta variant? And I'm assuming he didn't mention the fact that he also got vaccinated. So let's just assume we're talking to someone that got COVID, but not the vaccination.
Yeah, this is an important topic. We do know from a variety of studies that natural infection does provide good immunity to reinfection. It's not perfect, nothing is, but we should be acknowledging that if you were infected, and really we can document that it was truly COVID, that you likely have protection. We don't know how long that protection lasts. We know that getting at least one dose of vaccine does boost your immune response, and it increases the breadth, we call it, so that you're covering better protected from more variants. But yes, very likely if you had COVID and it was a robust infection, you have some immunity, that immunity looks to be protecting from reinfections in some of the studies that are out there. The advantage of getting vaccinated is that you'll boost that immunity to a slightly higher level and perhaps actually increase the coverage against Delta or other variants.
Dr. Gounder, Beth asks, is public transportation okay to use? What if you can't physically distance?
Yeah, this is something I actually would like to revise in our previous conversation. One of the things that we've learned over the course of the pandemic is that this is primarily an airborne aerosol transmitted virus, not droplet spread. So the 6-foot rule is all about droplet spread. The main mechanism of transmission is aerosols. And so how do you protect against aerosols? It is masks, it is ventilation. So if you are on public transportation, you know, where it's a closed container, you can't open windows, your best protection is going to be wearing a mask. So I would up your game on your mask, a KN95, and then go at times where it's less crowded, because the more dense it is, and this is not about how far you are from a person, but the more number of people in that subway car, in that bus, the probability of one of those people having COVID is going to be that much higher. You know, it's kind of like the more coin flips you get, the more heads, you know, more your chances of eventually getting heads. So go, you know, at times of day when there are just fewer people.
Here's a question from Marisol. I'll put this to you, Dr. Wary. Are you concerned that we should be masking in crowded outdoor settings or only indoors?
Oh, I think crowded outdoor as well. We know from early in the pandemic that transmission outside is significantly less efficient than transmission inside. But I think this relates back to what Dr. Gounder just said about airflow and ventilation. Outside, typically, you have more airflow and better ventilation. But crowded outdoor events have also been shown to result in transmission and spreading events. Some super spreader events early in the pandemic were largely outdoor activities. So absolutely, masking at outdoor environments where it's crowded would definitely be advised.
And to you, Dr. Gounder, Thomas asks, would nasal spray vaccines be able to reduce transmission?
This is a very good question. And part of the reason we see the vaccines protect so well against severe disease, and if you think about it, severe disease is when it's in the lungs.
Right.
It's because the immunity you get from vaccination from the shot is really better in the lungs than it is in the nose and throat. And this question about nasal vaccines is a good one, because what we see with nasal vaccines is they may induce better immunity in the nose, the upper airway. And so one of the things we may well be looking at in the future is combining the shot, you know, as one dose, and then maybe a nasal dose as well, so that we can optimize your immunity in both locations, the upper airway and the lower airway.
You worked, Dr. Gounder, on the Ebola outbreak and crisis of a couple of years ago. Any lessons that were learned from Ebola that we could apply to today?
Oh, yeah, we have a very short-term memory.
We do.
And we don't like, you know, we don't like to continue doing something like funding public health any longer than absolutely in our minds necessary. I think, to me, what was so tragic about what I saw unfolding in West Africa was a lot of the work we did was to try to build up health systems, to train people on the ground, to develop surveillance and capacity like that. And then over the years afterwards, the money that was being invested to develop and sustain those systems was pilfered and used for other things, taken away. The human resources, the people we were developing and training on the ground, they lost their jobs. All of that, you know, much of that capacity has now been lost. And we call this the U-shaped curve of public health emergencies, where you have a crisis, you have this big influx of funding, we do a lot, and then the crisis goes away and we dismantle everything. And then the next crisis hits and then you find yourself back to square one. And I fear that is what we're going to do all over again.
Do you have the same fear, Dr. Wary?
I do. I mean, we have had the entire sort of scientific community, at least in immunology, infectious disease, microbiology, virology, turn almost uniformly and completely our attention to SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19 over the past 18 months. And the reality is that all these scientists also have day jobs and all of the things that they were doing before the pandemic that they now need to return to. And so we're going to be left in some cases with a bit of a vacuum of intellectual resources, personnel, and funding to continue and to finish the job, really, of making sure we close out what we need to close out here and, you know, bring the pandemic to an end.
You're saying because of a shortage and just the way people have been deployed that we're shorthanded?
Yeah, I think, you know, I talked to a lot of my non-science friends, who wonder how we can't know the answer to various questions. And the reason is because we really do have limited resources. There just aren't enough hours in the day, people on the ground, and frankly, funding to be able to answer all of the questions. So we have to prioritize and we have to sort of put our resources where we can have the most benefit in the quickest amount of time. Early in the pandemic, when everything else was shut down, we had a very large community of scientists, researchers, and physicians who were doing nothing but trying to understand COVID-19 for good reason. You know, this was, you know, very much like the Manhattan Project of, you know, the World War II era. But now that we've sort of moved forward and things are returning back to normal, there are other things that were occupying the attention of a lot of these scientists before that.
Well, I'll tell you what, another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. I want to pick up on that. That's Dr. John Wary. He's chair of pharmacology, director of the Institute for Immunology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Celine Gounder with us as well, clinical assistant professor of medicine and infectious diseases at New York University School of Medicine and Bellevue Hospital. We'll be right back. This is Radio.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with our guests about what we know about COVID and the Delta variant, vaccines, masking, and we want to hear from you. Any questions or comments, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Dr. Wary, I want to go back to you. You talked about the fact that there are these sort of outstanding, unanswered questions, and I'm just curious what some of them are.
Sure, yeah. I think one of the biggest ones is how long does immunity last? And, you know, this is not a simple or a, you know, a one-layer question. We know that the real-world protection we're seeing looks pretty good so far, but we're also seeing reports come out about measuring how long antibodies last in vaccinated people. And, of course, antibodies are, we're all becoming familiar with them. They're what protect us. They're like sticking a piece of gum on the key so the key can't get in the lock. The virus can't get into our cells. But there are other parts of the immune system that get primed by these vaccines that can play a role in protecting us, but they're just much harder to measure. So we're starting to get little hints of information out there about how durable these other parts of the immune response are. Mm. We need to understand how much they contribute to protection, when they might wane and disappear, and how that influences our decisions about booster vaccines.
And to you, Dr. Gowner, what outstanding questions do you have?
Well, I agree this question of how long immunity lasts. I think a key complementary question is, what do we measure to predict that? And the problem with measuring antibodies is it's normal for your antibody levels to go down. We have other cells that provide memory so that if you see that same virus, that same bacterium again, your body is ready to jump into action immediately and produce those antibodies again. Normally, when you see something for the first time, it takes time to develop that antibody response. But we don't yet know how best to predict that your body has that memory. If you continued to produce antibodies to everything that you ever saw, your blood would literally turn to sludge. So there's a reason we have these other systems in place to elicit an immune response over time.
Here's a question from Paul at Drexel, and this, I think, first part is aimed at me. Earlier, you stated that the virus is transferable from vaccinated people. Other media organizations have been reporting this, but clearly public health experts say that this type of transmission is very rare. Without adding the qualification that this is rare, you alarm vaccinated people. Do you have data that this transmission is not rare? Let me just make sure that there's no confusion, and perhaps, Dr. Gowner, I can go back to you. I thought I made it clear, but I want to make it very clear to our listeners if there's any confusion about the protection that people get from being being vaccinated from the Delta variant.
Yes, so the vaccines are highly protective against severe.
Oh dear, I think we lost her. Do you want to finish her sentence? Okay, I think we.
Hello?
Yeah, we lost you just for a second there. If you don't mind, Dr. Gowner, just start again.
Yeah, so I was just saying the vaccines are very protective, highly protective against severe disease, hospitalization, and death. With respect to breakthrough infection, those are still exceedingly rare, and your risk of transmitting onwards to others are therefore exceedingly rare. So we really, you know, I would feel very confident if you've been vaccinated that you're protected, that you're not a very high risk to other people, and vaccines really are our way out of the pandemic.
And we're talking about less than 1%, correct?
0.08%
there
is
you
the
go.
Estimate.
Exactly. Dr. Wary, anything you want to add to that?
Just reiterating, completely agree. We know that the vaccines prevent severe infection and that will also limit the amount that people spread.
Here's a question from Kimberly. My vaccinated friend recently tested positive for COVID. Is it likely she was infected with the Delta variant? Dr. Wary, I mean, without testing her, would it be possible to answer that question?
Well, statistically, it's very likely. I think the estimates are somewhere between 93% and 97% of all virus that's been, you know, sequenced or identified in the country in the past couple of days has been Delta variant. So we have switched over almost entirely to Delta in the U.S.
And Dr. Gowner, picking up on what you're talking about, masks, a lot of people are saying, so K95, use that, and are cloth masks completely useless?
Cloth masks are not completely useless. I think of the masks on a spectrum. So, you know, cloth masks provide some level of protection. Your surgical masks are another level. KN95 is perhaps even better than that. And then N95 is even better than that. But I think at this stage, given that supply is not a constraint, given that we are dealing with a far more infectious virus than we were early in the pandemic, a KN95 is really what we would be recommending to the general public at this stage.
Fair enough. Here's a question from Sam for you, Dr. Wary. We have two kids about to start daycare. Any recommendations for risk for young children and the Delta variant?
Yeah, we know that kids can get sick. It is a little bit more rare than in adults. I think, you know, choosing a daycare wisely where the daycare staff is vaccinated, yourselves being careful about what you do as parents. And then I think if possible, you know, just being very, very aware of events that occur in the daycare and testing where you can.
Brian says, I'm fully vaccinated. I had no qualms about getting the vaccination. But is it fair to mandate getting vaccines before they have been approved by the FDA? Dr. Gowner, you were talking about the FDA. What do you say to Brian?
Yeah, I've actually spoken to a number of legal scholars, people who specialize in public health law about this. And yes, it is completely legal for whether it's a local jurisdiction or state or federal government to be mandating vaccination. If you look at how many doses of vaccine have been administered worldwide now, it's over 4 billion doses, over 350 million doses of vaccine here in the United States. We have ample data to be able to say, you know, look, these are safe vaccines. You know, what the FDA is really finalizing its opinion on is things like what exactly is the best regimen. Let's make sure all of the manufacturing facilities are really up to where they need to be. But in terms of the safety and efficacy of the vaccines, I think the jury is in, and these are quite safe and effective.
Let me introduce something else. We haven't really talked about contact tracing. And I want to go back to you, Dr. Wary. And I understand that the CDC essentially stopped tracking mild to moderate breakthrough cases, really only focusing on hospitalizations and death. Should we sort of re-up contact tracing, or how should we best use it?
Well, I think there are really two kinds of answers here. The one is contact tracing can be extremely powerful to limit the spread of infectious disease. And, you know, I'm sure Dr. Gounder could talk about this in the Ebola settings. This is one of the ways we did eradicate smallpox was by doing contact tracing and then ring vaccination, we called it, vaccinating the contacts of people infected. So contact tracing can be extremely powerful in these kinds of settings. The second part of the answer, though, is that with the amount of infection that we have in the U.S. right now, the resources that it would take to do really effective contact tracing are just mm-hmm. enormous. And then the benefit we get from that compared to putting those resources in trying to get enough people vaccinated, we probably get a bigger bang for our buck by trying to make sure we get vaccination rates up higher than putting those resources into contact tracing.
Do you agree with that, Dr. Gounder?
I think the Provincetown outbreak is the counter argument to that, which is that I think we think of contact tracing as benefiting the people involved in the outbreak directly. And I think what we learned from the Provincetown outbreak, that was basically a massive contact tracing effort. We learned a lot about the virus based on that outbreak. And I think that that cannot be underestimated how much we do learn from those investigations. And that's information that can be applied to public health measures for the broader public. So I think we really did drop contact tracing efforts prematurely. And unfortunately, we've let a lot of those contact tracers, that workforce, go. Those are people who could have been enlisted in trying to get more people vaccinated right now. We've lost that workforce now.
Just related to this, Dr. Wary, I'm thinking about, is home testing, is that on the horizon? Would that be a good tool to have?
Yeah, I think home testing is a great tool to have for a variety of reasons. There are challenges with that, as we all could imagine, interpreting tests, you know, correctly administering tests and other things. But I think it helps a tremendous amount for people to know their status and be able to make informed decisions, at least to the extent that you can be informed by a home test, to change behaviors, limit spread, and self-quarantine if you need to.
And here's a question from Tim to you, Dr. Gounder. My wife and I are over 65, got the vaccine in January. Is there any harm in getting a booster?
So this is one of the things the FDA is trying to figure out right now, is what is the optimal regimen. If you look at old school vaccination regimens, they were generally given as, you know, day zero, 2 months later, you get your second dose. 6 months later, you get a third dose. It's kind of like what we do for hepatitis B, for example. And I think there, at least for certain populations, we may be headed towards something like that, a three-dose regimen. But I think it's also going to be targeted at very specific groups. So highly immunosuppressed people, for example, who've had a solid organ transplant, perhaps people over the age of 80, people living in nursing homes, those would be the really highest risk people who can benefit the most. If you look at where you get the most bang for your buck from vaccination, It's not necessarily from optimizing the immunity of people who've already been vaccinated, so giving them extra doses. It's by giving unvaccinated people, getting them vaccinated, that we actually get the most protection for all of us.
Let me go back to you, Dr. Wary, and I'm happy to say that it looks like vaccination rates have been going up in the last week or so. And I've also seen some really powerful and poignant messages of people who were opposed to vaccinations. They got COVID. They ended up in the hospital on ventilators. You know, they lived through it, but it was a horror. And I wonder, in terms of messaging, how powerful and important you think that kind of messaging is.
I think it's very important. And I think that, the reality of these kinds of situations is that the anecdotes carry a lot of weight. And that happens on both sides of the equation here. Mm-hmm. So I think the more of those personal stories that are out there, the more people we can touch, the more people we can say, hey, that person is kind of like me, and it relates on a personal level. I think the other part of telling those stories are telling the stories of the long-term consequences. We don't talk about this much, but people that have had COVID, a very significant percentage, have long-term consequences that can last for months, change their lives for a very long time, have real consequences, both in need of additional medical care, brain fog, not being able to think the same way, cardiovascular, respiratory problems, and other neurological problems. So we need to also be talking about this as not just, did I survive the 2 weeks of fever? It's what happens in the long term and how many people really have these long term consequences.
And picking up on that, Dr. Gowner, I mean, sometimes you hear it's more anecdotal, is that people have said that they're more afraid of the vaccine than they are of the virus.
Yeah, that's certainly what we're hearing among people who are still not yet vaccinated, and in particular among younger people, that is what they are afraid of. I think a subset of that are women who are hoping to get pregnant, and I do want to be very clear for your audience. If you are trying to get pregnant, you are pregnant, you're breastfeeding, the vaccines are safe, they are effective. One of the most important things you can do is get vaccinated to protect your baby, to protect yourself. One of the worst things you can do is to get COVID while you're pregnant. That is really dangerous for you and your baby.
Here's a question from Victor. Should cities be having large outdoor events in Philadelphia? They're planning to hold the Made in America Festival with 75,000 people expected. John, where are you and I are in Philadelphia? What do you think?
Yeah, my opinion is that this is probably not a great idea right now. I think that it's very difficult. I understand the other side of the equation, economic activity, returning to, people's jobs and things like that. But, there's still a considerable risk to public health.
And what about travel?
Yeah, travel is something that we're seeing a lot of return to travel. I think that with proper masking on planes, it seems that this is not a huge risk of transmission. The data is kind of scant. We don't really have that much data on this. But I think if things are managed properly, it does seem like the risk of travel is not as high as some other activities. But I would still think about it very carefully.
And to you, Dr. Gowner, we're almost out of time here. I mean, we are, we're struggling to deal with this pandemic, this current pandemic. Is this preparation for the next one?
I hope so. I am very nervous. I think as climate change becomes more and more of a public health threat, and that will, by the way, also lead to more emerging infectious diseases, I am very nervous that we can come together and sacrifice on behalf of the greater good, on behalf of public health, because that's what it's really going to take. And so our experience of the last 19, 20 months now, really, to me, has me very concerned about the next big crisis.
Because of how people have behaved, you mean, more than anything else?
Yeah, because I think we're going to have to come together, sacrifice on behalf of this greater good in order to combat something like this. Had we decided, we're going to implement every tool in our toolbox to the maximum, we would be on the other side of COVID right now.
Wow.
We would be as a nation. And so I think that lack of resolve, that lack of what I would call patriotism, really believing in something bigger than yourself, that has me very, very scared for the future.
Well, those are powerful words, and I appreciate both of you joining us today in Radio Times. Celine Gowner, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And she is clinical assistant professor of medicine and infectious diseases at New York University School of Medicine and Bellevue Hospital. John Wary, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And he's professor, chair of pharmacology, and director of the Institute for Immunology at the Perelman School of Medicine. That's at the University of Pennsylvania. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.